Hello and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutin.
Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. In a recent joint statement, the think tanks, the Institute for Democracy and Economic Affairs, as well as the Center for Market Education, they've expressed concern over what they believe to be insufficient debate over economic policy and its long-term consequences. Now, the think tanks cite as examples the special EPF withdrawals, the management of Maharashtra, the price ceilings on chicken as well as RTK tests, and the revision of the minimum wage. Now, how do we ensure that there's more substantive discussion around economic policy decisions as well as its consequences? And would that lead to better governance? Joining us now is Tricia Yeo. She is the CEO of IDEAS, one of the think tanks in the joint statement. Tricia, why do you think policy debate lately has taken a back seat as opposed to other things? Is this something that you've seen as a recent trend, or has this always been the case for Malaysia?
Thank you, Melissa, for having me on. I do think that policy debate has always been relatively weak in a country like Malaysia, where ideology does not feature as strongly as one of the determinants for which parties are formed, and therefore also supporters, you know, flock to those parties. Nevertheless, I think in the wake of what happened in 2018, definitely just before that, and in fact, post-2018 in the by-elections, the state elections and so on, there seems to be probably a minutely little bit more in terms of the policy debate going into those elections. So you do have manifestos. Those manifestos do spell out some policies. But I think in the recent weeks and months, this has again taken a back seat because of multiple reasons, one of which is that there's always this speculation about when the next general election is going to take place. We know, for example, that the MOU between government and the opposition MPs is expiring in July. And so there's a lot of fixation, public fixation, you know, political, both political and public, and also in the media about the expiry of this MOU, about the next general election that's coming about, you know, focus on politics itself. So politics will always have its fair share, and it is important to talk about it. I mean, we don't shy away from it, but we just believe that the lack of policy discourse, and in the last few weeks and months, there have been a series of successive events and policy decisions that have been made, which really could have been discussed in so much more depth. The politicians themselves, you know, have not really made that kind of substantive contribution to
can I jump in there and ask you, Ray, how many politicians, how many members of the Federal Assembly do you think have the capacity to do this? I mean, to do the talk, you know, to have those, you know, really informed debates and discussions about trade-offs that are involved in policy making, because they come to power not on the back of creating policy. They come on the back, come to power on the back of political maneuvering. The sandiwara and, you know, the drama of politics is what really animates our political system, doesn't it? And those are the people who come to power. They're not thinkers necessarily, are they?
I mean, absolutely. I think you could name probably on one hand, maybe if you're generous, two hands, the number of members of parliament who are really interested and who are engaged in policy, some of whom are actually leaving, right? So you're right that the system itself does not incentivize the kind of thinkers who you would like to contribute meaningfully to the policy debate. That speaks to so many things on so many levels. And I can, you know, say immediately like two things that in the long term, the system needs to encourage in order to incentivize new, young, fresh politicians who are interested in policy. Number one, it would be the ways in which the community and the public expects their MPs to behave for them. And, you know, this is really about whether the financial allocation system to the MPs would be provided equitably. And this is something that we are calling for. So I'm talking about constituency development funds, as well as public funding of political parties. There's a lot of talk right now on political financing reforms, and, you know, IDEAS is one of them that's mooting this. We believe that equitable allocation of constituency development funds and public funding for political parties would create a more level playing field. Therefore, people don't have to depend so much on their MPs because it's more equal, and, you know, it does not become so political anymore, aligning yourself with the right coalition. So that's one big thing. The other second big thing is that Parliament itself is not seen as the right institution in which policy debate happens, because so much of it happens in the executive, right? So if we give more resources to Parliament, where the Parliament Library, the Parliamentary Research Officers, the entire institution of Parliament becomes a thriving source of policy research, that's where the MPs, even backbenchers, you know, people who are not in government, they will feel like they can play a more active role. Because right now, it pretty much is a rubber stamp. And right. You're right that their constituents are the ones that determine whether or not they win or lose. So
Tricia, so just something that's happened in the news lately with the Anwar and Najib debate, would you consider that robust policy discussion?
So it was good in the first instance. I mean, let's encourage this form of policy debates at all, which, you know, was not possible, say, 20 years ago or even 10. But I think the contents, again, could have been more substantive. The points that were raised by both of the individuals seemed to, well, some of it was substantive. I mean, some of the discussion was about, you know, scandals, about, you know, GDP and the economy and so on. But I think, again, like, if I were to have done the debate, let's just put it this way, instead of, you know, unnecessarily being too critical, I think I would have really brought up a lot of the more recent economic policies that have been quite, you know, could possibly put our economy into jeopardy. So this was what we referred to in the statement. It was the EPF withdrawal. It was the whole debate about the My Sejahtera app, for example.
But you know, political debates like that, even if they are about real substantive policy issues, don't necessarily tend to translate into good governance. So that there's often this argument that, well, you know, it's often a lot of grandstanding by politicians using real issues that will affect the rakyat.
Yeah, but I think that it will not necessarily lead to that. But what is the theory of change here? And of course, we think a lot about this, right? The theory of change here is that the more they talk about it, or the more public debate there is about a certain topic, the hope is that there is a groundswell of dissatisfaction from among the public. And this feeling is actually responded to at the political level. So what we want, for example, is that a very rigorous discussion on, for example, the EPF withdrawal and how this will jeopardize future retirees. We want that kind of discontent, public discontent, to be felt and then discussed at the cabinet, for example. So
Tricia, I want to, yeah, because we're running out of time and this is a really important discussion. I want to know what your sort of ideal image of, and one that's in some sense realistic, you know, for policy, especially in a country where there is a premium placed on the theater of power and all that goes with it, and very little on, say, what's happening in our civil service? Is there strong policy orientation in civil service? Over the last couple of years, everything's been outsourced to, it seems, consultants, and you know, and any number of blueprints and 5-year plans have been, you know, published, but to what effect?
So what could this realistically look like, right? I would say that in many countries in which it was a lot more ground-up participatory in the policy decision-making or the policy discourse, right, it does not necessitate hiring expensive consultants, like not at all. A lot of it happens in a very informal way, but the main thing is that the process needs to be structured. So what you could envision, for example, I mean, we just have to use public imagination for this, set up at the local council level or at state level or at, you know, ministry level, a kind of public-private platform in which consultations happen on a regular basis rather than just depending or relying on consultations during an emergency or consultations during a certain law that's about to be passed. So if you have this regular platform, it could be, you know, comprised of professionals and civil society together, then these consultations would already mean that they're happening regularly and there's no such thing as a surprise. I think one thing we fall short of is not having this consistency. And of course, sometimes people change, right, at the political level, at, you know, government administrative level, even civil servants, although they stay for longer, they change as well. But the main thing is there continuity so that there is institutional memory in which these relationships can be formed. And that's where I think you can then, each of these people would go back to their own constituents and bring that discussion back to their own societies and communities, for example.
Right. And just on that note, Tricia, how well received do you think the public would be to policy discussions? Again, you know, all of this is wonderful, but it really requires participation from an engaged citizenry. Is that always the case when it comes to policy discussion?
I think sometimes we tend to take on a very patronizing approach, thinking that citizens don't care. But actually, they do if the opportunities are given to them. So the way engagement needs to happen should not be high level as well. So engagement needs to happen. So there are certain principles that you can follow, right? The engagement can happen, but the engagement must be, must be accessible. The engagement must be accessible, must be clearly understood by the community. There have been many examples around the world, and there was an example in Penang as well, I think, where they did this experiment and asking people, how do you want the money to be spent? Like, tell us. So if local governments or state governments or even ministry level ask, do you have ideas about how the money can be spent? I'm telling you, people do have ideas. People have ideas because they have problems. And they have problems, they have concerns, they have families, they live in the neighborhood, they're concerned about, you know, potential landslides that happen every time the flood takes place. They're concerned about, you know, sinkholes on the road. So these things actually are practical. I mean, we don't have to think about them as too high level, really. We just want to take the approach that people do care. And if given the opportunity and it is accessible, they will do it.
Tricia, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. Tricia Yeo, CEO of Ideas. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back with more. Stay tuned to Consider This. Hi, thanks so much for staying with Strad and I on Consider This. Dr. Carmelo Felito joins us now. He is the CEO of Center for Market Education, which is one of the think tanks that express concern over what it believes to be insufficient debate on economic policy and its long-term consequences. Carmelo, we spoke to Tricia Yeo a little bit earlier, CEO of Ideas, and she pointed out how there might be a lack of clarity or even real difference in the spectrum of ideology when it comes to economic policy. And I'm just wondering how that might influence what you claim to be insufficient debate on the consequences of economic policy. Is the assumption that, you know, ideological differences or preferences, there needs to be significant differences in these preferences, or else you can't have good policy debate?
I totally agree, and thanks for having me, Melissa and Sharad. You know, we need differences. And indeed, I think that often the proper solutions emerge in a confrontation between different perspectives and evaluating pros and cons of different approaches. And somehow this helps fine-tuning or finding a right path. In the end, we are talking about a country, Malaysia, with 30 million people, whereby probably solutions that fit all individuals are impossible to find. And therefore, listening and debating different positions is probably the way to go. And it seems the way that we are not instead trying to push at the moment.
Carlito, if I can ask you about this idea of ideology, and often we use left to right. I see ideas and your center as sort of being centrist and to the right, your think tank pushing the idea of market solutions, perhaps much stronger than ideas. But in some sense, philosophically, I think the both the think tanks on the same side. I mean, what is the ideological, I mean, when you look at it, what is the ideological spectrum that is available? And how is that lack of spread shaping the kinds of solutions that are that are being produced?
I would say, I would try a little bit to go beyond the usual spectrum, left and right, planning against market. And I was reflecting about this in the past days, because a very famous economist, Axel Legenfood, passed away, and we had different ideological perspectives, but we also agreed on one point, that the policymaking requires humility. So he was coming from a Keynesian background. I'm coming, is very well known, from a market approach, Hayek, Friedman, Buchanan, and so on. But if I read his writings, I find this stress on the importance of humility. So I think that the actual debate now in policymaking is between those who believe that we can identify in size achievable targets and implement policies that can indeed drive to achieve quantifiable targets, like, let's say, you want to have a certain percentage of unemployment or a certain percentage of inflation, and you believe you can achieve that with certain policies. And on the other spectrum, there are those people who believe that are more things on heaven and earth than there are dreamt in your philosophy, Horatio, like Shakespeare was used to write. And I belong to this second spectrum. So reality is complex, and having and being aware of this complexity brings you to a position of humility of what you actually can do on reality. So because the risk otherwise is not really to pursue what is called a social optimum, but to pursue what politicians believe to be the social optimum, which is very different.
Well, that's a really good point, because again, you know, some of these decisions that have been made, the economic policies that have been made recently, have been through political pressure. I'm just thinking about the EPS special withdrawals. That was not without its political pressures. That was a very that was not without rigorous discussion, I'm sure, as well. But where do you see the failings in that? For example, we saw in the lead up to the decision being announced for EPF withdrawals, economists and think tanks such as yourself coming out to say there are long-term consequences for this, but yet we still saw political pressure perhaps sway those policy-making decisions. How do we then ensure that discussion doesn't just become empty talk?
Yeah, I think that here is a matter of the maturity also of the political spectrum. And you see, it's not, it is quite obvious that politicians look for short-term solutions because they look at the possibility of being re-elected, and therefore they tend to disregard the long-term unintended consequences. But then what's the role of an opposition? So there are think tanks. Think tanks have tried to create awareness about these risks. These television or radio shows also help to create that awareness. But where is the opposition in all this? Because we are not there to fight in parliament to try to change bills. We don't have that power. So I wonder why that kind of, thorn in the side is not played by the opposition.
Well, I mean, there is the Socialist Party. I mean, it's sort of a distinctive political party in the sense that it is kind of founded on an ideology, perhaps, a 20th century ideology, if the critics, want to pan it. But I want to ask you about the fact that the state does produce policy all the time. And we have five-year plans a la the Soviet Union. I mean, the 12th Malaysia plan, all these things. Aren't these examples of policy making?
But I think that the 5 years plan is not really policy making, and is not even a policy debate. It could be good as a starting point for a discussion, but is too broad and too general to be a policy. Obviously, it's like a statement of desires, a wish list, if we want. But then what we need afterwards is discussion, and then practical implementations. And I think that is much more easy to act on small details of reality rather than on big and probably a little bit utopistic targets. In a few years, maybe this government will not be there anymore. Someone else comes. Those things are forgotten. But in general, there is the problem with the idea behind the 5 years plan, which is that indeed the economy can be driven directly, like if it was an engine, like if it was a car, and you can steer it, it breaks down, you can fix it. But my point is that it doesn't work like that. It's much more complicated than that, because the economy is made of millions of individuals' decisions and inter-individuals' actions. Right. But this is precisely, I don't want to convert, everybody to believe the things that I believe, but these are precisely the things that we should discuss. As you mentioned, probably even my position and ideas position have moved in different directions, but at least we talk, we discuss what do you believe about that, and we try to see and to push you to the idea to find a common understanding. This is right. What I see lacking in this moment.
Well, so everyone has a role to play, think tankers, politicians, opposition, government, as well as the media. And I'm just wondering, Carmelo, in the few minutes that we have left, what is it that you would like us to be more, to have more rigorous and vibrant debate on? We've talked about the EPF withdrawals, the MySejahtera, all of that. Those decisions have been made. But what can we ensure that we are talking about to ensure that there is actually discussion before decisions are taken on?
I think the starting point should be that every kind of policy has consequences that don't go in the direction that policymakers desire. So this is a point of awareness, and this is the point that I see absent in the discussion. So it's like, I want to go there, I do this, I go there, and there will be nobody left on the side. And I think that this is the message that we need really to leave to the people and to the policymakers. Like Thomas Sowell was used to say, and he still used to say, there are no solutions, there are only trade-offs. We have to learn how to deal with trade-offs.
And so
that's a tough one.
Yeah. So very quickly, if you were going to set out an agenda for, say, the next year, and you were trying to kind of influence the media to take up this agenda, what issues would you put on the table?
I think that the main issues are further liberalization of the job market at ASEAN level. This is one point. Tax reform is another point. I would like to see more tax reform directed toward the consumption tax, and a great reform of Malaysia Inc. So the GST system, yes, that I think is the big elephant in the room in the case, right, of Malaysia.
Okay. Thank you so much, Carmelo, for joining us on the show. Dr. Carmelo Felito, they're wrapping up this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutan, signing off for the evening.
Thank you so much for watching, and good night.